Welcome to Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, pull it apart and put the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. This season, we're untangling Ohio's housing crisis. From why Gen Z thinks the dream of homeownership is a fantasy, why millennials feel stuck in their starter homes, and why baby boomers are finding themselves priced out by property taxes. We're untangling the facts behind all those feelings. This is Episode 3, The Corporate Landlord Next Door. Every story needs a good villain. And when it comes to the housing crisis, rich investors backed by Wall Street banks make ideal antagonists. These big venture capital firms swooping into cities like Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, and gobbling up homes that should go to first-time buyers. They outbid young families with all-cash offers and then turn around and mistreat their tenants, increasing evictions and rental prices. It's a great story. Wall Street cashes in on the American dream, but we wanted to know if it's true. Just how many homes are owned by these companies? And perhaps more importantly, how do we define institutional investor?
I'm a housing provider. My parents and I started a business about 20 years ago. And so we have mostly single family homes that we consider long-term rentals.
That's Deborah Collins. She owns 15 single family homes and one apartment complex in the greater Cincinnati area.
So I'm part of a real estate investing association in Cincinnati. We have about 900 members. Most of them are local independent investors in that area. And there's plenty of them that own anywhere between 20 and 50 properties, some of them up to 100. Generally speaking, they still consider themselves, you know, mom and pop. I mean, like, they're bigger, obviously, and they would have staff and offices and stuff. I still work out of my home. I work part-time, you know, so I still consider myself a mom and pop and an independent housing provider and very much still a small business. And that may be some of the confusion with some of the legislation that comes out that's trying to target institutional investors, because they'll put those numbers down and they put like 50 and above. And 50 properties is not an institutional investor. And that really then leads to some really harsh unintended consequences to our local housing providers.
Deborah makes an important point. How we define the different categories of real estate investors matter. And if we're going to talk about institutional investors, we need to decide, is 50 homes too big to be a small business? 100 homes? 1,000 homes? Republican Senator Bill Blessing is attempting to draw a line in the sand here in Ohio with Senate Bill 76. The law would tax big investors for each home they own, and the line he's chosen is 50 homes in a single county. So, Senator Blessing, can you explain how you landed on that number?
So that number was arrived upon in talks with a number of stakeholders, and it's interesting because originally I had it significantly higher. I think it was originally 350 in my mind, and as you said, you're right. You have to draw a line somewhere, and my thought was originally, you know, with 350. That would have been enough to knock out some of the big guys. So, for example, there is a large institutional housing investor, quite often in the news, in Hamilton County that owns north of 3,000 single-family homes in the entire county. So, obviously, 350 would have been enough to, you know, knock them out of the running for something like this. But I had heard from, you know, a number of these folks that said 50 and, you know, above is just not that many entities that are at that point. So 50 was what we went with, and that's where we're at.
It's also really hard to figure out how many homes companies like Vinebrook or Invitation Homes own. These big multinational companies can have dozens of different sub-companies buying houses under different names, right?
Yes, that's correct. In the case of Hamilton County, it was I think something like 90 plus pass-through entities for this one entity which obviously makes it very difficult for city authorities and even the auditor to track it down.
I'm going to play a clip from Philip Denning. He's the executive vice president for the Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority. His team spent months sifting through records in Hamilton County to uncover more than 4,000 homes that belong to five big investment companies.
Tracking these acquisitions because of the data, the way the data is hidden and stored, was a really arduous task and required review of hundreds of thousands of property transactions during that time to really uncover a network of how properties are moving. This information was messy, but through our research, we found out that, for example, Vinebrook, an entity that is a for-profit institutional investment entity, had used 90 different LLCs to acquire more than 2,000 properties in Hamilton County within a couple of short years. And really, that lack of transparency is what is making it really hard for jurisdictions, especially smaller jurisdictions and townships, to figure out how to address when problems arise from that activity.
So, Senator Blessing, you're from a small township, Coleraine Township. How are smaller communities kind of struggle? Like, what is the problem that's posed when you can't figure out how many homes a company owns in an area?
So, I'd start with I don't know that I would say Coleraine is a small township. It's quite large at a population of roughly 60,000.
Oh, but, much bigger. Okay.
But that said, a lot of times these entities will target specific neighborhoods. And the biggest challenge with it, is that when you buy up so much in a small area very quickly, it drives home prices and rents in those areas up very quickly, which then, of course, when values rise, it's also going to impact those, for example, seniors who are on fixed incomes, see the property values rising and rising and rising. Their property taxes go up by virtue of something like this. In addition, it's very difficult for the local authorities to, go after building code violations, levy fines for those sorts of things. And a lot of times the housing stock deteriorates because they're just simply not taking care of the homes.
Nationally, Invitation Homes owns about 80,000 single-family homes. American Homes for Rent has about 50,000. But they don't own all types of homes in all types of neighborhoods. What is the kind of home that they're targeting down in southwestern Ohio?
So, and that's sort of where, some of the misconceptions are with this. Folks will say, well, they're not a large percentage nationwide or even within the state of Ohio. And that may be true, but the difference is that they strike certain neighborhoods. Typically, they're the neighborhoods with the smaller Cape Cods, the War Boxes, I think those were called Lustran housing, that were meant to originally house the returning GIs after World War II. But in those areas where they strike, you're getting deep into double-digit percentages of ownership. So it's typically in more urban areas where they are active. The housing is typically what is seen as that, or what was seen at one time as a starter home.
They're typically about 20-ish percent below what the median home price is in an area, which means that's the kind of home that's most attractive to first-time buyers, right?
Yes, that's correct. And that's one of the more insidious aspects of this, is when you knock out that lower rung of the housing ladder, you're forced to then rent for longer, which is really not good for our younger generations.
And they can also show up in transitional neighborhoods, which is just a fancy word for a place that investors are hoping to gentrify over the next couple of years. So here in Columbus, there are certain transitional neighborhoods like Franklinton that 38% of home sales in a year might be from these large institutional investors, but in more expensive areas like Dublin, it'll be less than 10%.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I would have used areas around Intel's development for this sort of thing.
Oh, for sure.
And if you know that there is likely going to be a lot of development in that area, if you know that a company like Intel and all the ancillary businesses are going to need a significant workforce, you know that whatever you buy up is probably going to have a significant return on investment. So it makes good business sense for them to come in there and try to buy up everything that they can.
So you want to limit these companies' ability to buy housing stock in Ohio, but you're running into a pretty big roadblock within your own party. So the GOP tends to believe that it's wrong to fine private businesses that want to invest in communities, that, to quote Christina Rogener, a senator from your own caucus, government shouldn't be weaponizing policy to go after certain kinds of private business.
Yeah, that's correct. I do understand that I have issues with my own party on this one. I also think there's a misunderstanding with what we're trying to do here. I've always characterized this as more of an anti-monopoly, antitrust sort of bill that, again, tries to keep home prices in line, offers more home ownership opportunities. You know, the analogy that I used, and it's you know, there are certain things where the free market, you know, if you let it go to its logical conclusion, isn't a great thing. So, for example, the example that I used in sponsor testimony was, let's suppose that the free market was such that somebody went into groceries and bought up all the, you know, food, you name it, and then turned around, jacked up the prices and sold it to everybody else. No government would stand for that sort of thing because food is something that you absolutely need, and housing also falls into that. So when you have this consolidated ownership of all of these entities, which of course they will then jack up rent, it'll lead to increases in home prices, it's actually it's going to have a very bad effect and has had a very bad effect on our larger political economy. And one thing I think they also miss is that it's really, at the end of the day, a tax on employers. If employers want to have employees that live and work in the same area, and yet housing continues to go up and up and up because people are trying to profit more and more and more from it, it just means significantly more wage inflation, which harms Ohio's overall business competitiveness.
It kind of reminds me of how we went after certain online resellers who were buying up toilet paper, PPE, all of those kind of supplies in the early days of the pandemic. I believe they actually ran afoul of certain state laws against profiting during a crisis period.
Yes, that's right. I can't remember the specific case or what the gentleman's name was, but he bought up, I think, quite a bit of hand sanitizer in you know, with the thought that he could then profit off something like that. However, that was put a stop to. That wasn't just allowed under the guise of, okay, it's a free market, you can buy up whatever you want and then sell it back. Yeah, that would and it was right for the government to step in on something like that.
So you kind of see this almost as a similar vein that, and it wouldn't prohibit these types of institutional investors. It would just make it more expensive for them to operate, right? It's like a $1,500 per month tax.
So that's the catch with this, in that it's really not a tax that anybody would ever pay. The idea is that it's saying that that tax is so onerous and that the, you know, system of common control with respect to trying to find out who owns what makes it so that 50 becomes the upper limit on the number of single-family homes that you can own. Nobody's going to be paying that sort of tax. The idea, and even it's actually listed in the bill's fiscal note, that the likely impact of this would be the larger entities would then be forced to sell their single-family homes.
Now, you did set it at 50, but I know, and you know, the policy is iterative, that it gets changed as it moves through the legislative process. Is there any wiggle room for you there on that number of homes, that limit?
Yeah, of course there is. I could go back to the original number. That's fine. But I think the bigger issue in all cases is getting something that my colleagues would likely go along with. And I don't think that they would go along with Senate Bill 76. And you know, as disappointing as that is to me, there are other avenues that we can approach to bring about a healthier housing environment here in Ohio. One of the things that I have focused on lately is just the transparency piece. Now, in order to get some better transparency, the thought was to have some sort of statewide registry where it's voluntary. If you're a housing provider, you would then, you know, list your system of common control, the number of pass-through entities you own, the housing that you own, you do all that voluntarily. But in order to get people to do this, what you then do is flip a lot of the tax incentives that Ohio has to being, instead of, okay, you automatically get this, to you can get this if you're on that registry. So, you know, case in point, there is a 10% non-business credits, 10% property tax rollback for 1, 2, 3 unit single family homes. But that is something that is, you know, available to these large institutional housing investors. To me, I think it's crazy that the state gives them money for being bad actors. The thought is simply, okay, you're getting it now. We'd like to know the structure that you have, so you have to be on this registry if you want to continue getting something like that. It's quite simple, and I have found that a lot more of my colleagues are in favor of that sort of approach because it allows the locals to do more with that knowledge that they have.
It's about getting accurate data.
Oh, absolutely. And that's been the number one most difficult issue, I think, for the locals has been they just need transparency. They need to know who these people are. If they can get that, they consider that a big win. So for me, I'm willing to, park some of my, ideology in order to get them something that I think allows them to do their jobs.
And I think that's important because in order to have conversations about who is owning the homes in our neighborhood, we need to know who is owning them. And viral articles with bad data don't help because, spoiler alert, Wall Street investors aren't buying 44% of all homes sold in the United States. Coming up, we're moving outside of Ohio with a researcher who analyzed millions of home transactions over 2 decades. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a special series from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Now that we've established how Wall Street investors operate here in Ohio, we're going to expand to how companies like Blackstone, Innovation Homes, Vinebrook, and American Homes for Rent impact affordability across America. To do that, I'm bringing in Athena Tsudru, a finance professor at the University of Miami, Florida, who has been studying this exact issue. Welcome to Untangled.
Thank you so much, Anna. Nice to be here.
You co-authored a paper that attempted to answer whether this kind of housing investment is good or bad for affordability. But before we get into what you found, I want to go over what you studied. Can you tell us about the database you built?
Yes, sure. So the database comes from the housing transactions in the U.S. So these are in principle publicly available. So in any county, you can go and get the deeds that have all these ownership transfers of housing properties. What is not publicly available and easily to get is to get all of the transactions in the US and for many years. So there are some platforms that do collect all this data, they put it together and they make it available to academic institutions and the central bank. So this is how we got access to all the transactions.
And you looked at 85 million housing transactions over nearly 2 decades. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So for that study, the sample starts in the year 2000 until 2017. And we cover all the U.S.
And how did you identify institutional investors? What were you looking for in all these deeds and transactions?
So first of all, the data provider has a code that tells you if it's a corporate investor or not that is purchasing the home. However, we went even deeper than that, and we can read the names of the buyers. So it was, as you can imagine, a lot of work to go through all these transactions. To identify these institutional investors, like you mentioned, Invitation Homes, American Home for Rent, etc., we were searching for the keywords. But also, these have a lot of subsidiaries, so we had to search also in more detail about their subsidiaries, and etc. And then we also, in that study, we split. We have two types of investors, the big Wall Street landlords and also what we call small and medium-sized investors, that they do purchase through an LLC, so a legal entity, an LP, etc., and they buy multiple properties in the same area, in the same MSA.
So that what might be what we would call a local property investor, somebody in Columbus who maybe has 15, 20, 30 homes. They might be using an LLC, but that's not the same thing as a Wall Street investor.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. But the interesting fact that came out from this analysis was that these smaller landlords, they are way more in number and way spread in the geography of all throughout the U.S. Compared to the Wall Street landlords that are very concentrated in some cities.
So I finally get to ask the big question now, which is, what did you find when you crunched all these numbers?
So the first finding, we wanted to see where these investors are and understand what percentage of the houses they buy compared to houses that are bought by homeowners, right? So that's the classical participant in this market, that is the homeowners. So on average, they purchase about 10% of the stock in each metropolitan statistical area. And we wanted to understand if they cause some changes in the housing markets. So in areas with larger shares of investors, prices went up. And we wanted to get into affordability. So we also checked the price to income ratio in those areas. It went up. However, this increase was, it lasted 2-3 years. And then we also see that construction increases. So we also collect the data of the building permits. So in areas where there is a lot of demand, then this is picked up by developers, by builders, etc. And then there is more supply of housing, which eventually it didn't stop completely, but it moderated this price increase.
And institutional investors haven't traditionally looked at single-family homes as something they wanted in their portfolios, right? So you looked at 2000 to about 2017. This was something that these investors got into after the housing market crash in 2008, right? That's when this really ticks up.
Yes. So the main studies begins, so the main study about the price increases, et cetera, begins from 2009. Investors really entered the market after 2010, even we can say 2012, 13, in bulk. And there are a few factors I can think of. So first of all, because of the financial crisis, there were a lot of foreclosures. And then there were a lot of these bulk purchases. So there were houses available in bulk, and investors had the liquidity to go and purchase these. Another factor that we do explore in this research is that the interest rates were super low at that point in time and for more than 10 years. So this fixed income investment was not bringing high returns. And so real estate and getting rental income from these single family homes had higher returns. So it became more attractive.
And you said it's about 10% in metropolitan areas. But, you know, when you drill down into that data, I find it really fascinating that they tend to cluster in certain neighborhoods, certain zip codes. So we've seen that here in Ohio. So Vinebrook and American Homes for Rent own more than 12,000 homes in Ohio, which is not a huge amount of homes in the context of our entire state. But there were pockets where the percentage of home sales in these groups got pretty high. So a Washington Post investigation found that in Franklinton, one of those transitional neighborhoods here in Columbus, 38% of home sales, so one in three home sales, went to institutional investors in 2021. In Linden, the Hilltop, parts of Northeast Columbus over by the airport, it was the same story. But in our wealthier suburbs in Columbus, in, say, Dublin, Gahanna, Worthington, the percentage of homes going to institutional investors was in the single digits. I guess I just want to – is that kind of what you see in other cities, that these institutional investors like Vinebrook are clustering in very specific neighborhoods within cities?
Yes. So I can think of two reasons. Yes, there is clustering. And yes, like you said, I mentioned 10% in a metropolitan area. But then if you go to a zip code, it might be, like you said, up to 70%, etc. So there are benefits if you want to manage these properties because you want to rent them out and also provide services for the tenants, provide, you know, assistance whenever they need. You need to do the viewings. You need to also attend to the tenants. It's much easier if you have similar properties and geographically more concentrated, right? So there are these savings. Another thing that you mentioned is what we find is that the price increases and where investors were more attracted to were these bottom tier homes, so kind of smaller homes in the lower price range. And this, if you think about it, if we care about the ratio of the rent to price, of the rent of the home to the price they purchase, then the lower tier homes had a higher rent to price. So this is something that the investors go for.
So then smaller, cheaper houses in neighborhoods that are transitional, which is just a fancy way of saying it's a place investors hope to gentrify in the next couple of years. So they're looking for those homes at the lowest end of the market.
Yes, exactly. And also, if we think of the, you know, the profile of the tenants, these are new families that would have bought a home and now It is harder for them because prices started to go up. So they opt to, you know, they prefer to rent. And of course, this kind of small size home caters more to these tenants.
I want to zero in on a specific data point that you had in your paper. Can you tell us about the Chicago metro area and what you found there?
Yes. Yeah, so if I remember correctly, there are it was one of the areas with a relatively large share of investors. We find 12 to 16% over the period from 2009 to 2017. So average 12 to 16% per year share of purchases by investors. And the prices did go up a lot because there is this land restrictions, et cetera, that do affect prices.
At the beginning of this show, we introduced a woman named Deborah. She's a small local housing provider in the Cincinnati area. And she has a theory on how to get Wall Street investors out of neighborhoods without passing laws that would ban them from buying houses.
They've been very public, actually, about what areas of the country they target. They like to come in to places that have very high barriers to entry and low supply and very low competition. So right there, that's the playbook of if that's not the kind of owners you want in your area, if you're concerned about what they're bringing to your community, how do you get rid of them? You open up the supply gates. And I heard your podcast about the zoning. Cincinnati's working very hard to adjust their zoning rules. And if cities would do that and allow more production and increase the competition to these companies, their model of investing and their model of making money doesn't work anymore.
So essentially what she's saying is, I think what you found, that if there's a lot more construction in an area, that mitigates the price increases, and it sort of seems to discourage this institutional investing. Is that fair to say?
I think that the big picture to think about is that supply is key. The supply of housing is key. In any affordability discussions we do hear it a lot that building more houses is one of the key solutions. So when supply is restricted, then that's where prices spike and also rents might spike a lot. So this is in line with our findings.
So big takeaway from your research, it sounds like, you know, Wall Street investors, these big institutional investors, do increase prices in an area in the short term. But in the long term, it feels like it's a little more murky.
Yes, you could say that. You could say that. The price increases are mitigated. But it does depend how easy it is to build new houses in the area.
And I suppose it also depends just fundamentally, and this is something data can't tell us, on what we want those neighborhoods to look like. Do we want owner-occupied? Do we want a bunch of corporate rentals? How we want to build our neighborhoods and our communities?
Yeah, so there are different ways to look at this, because the institutional investors, I think they do have some bad press, but also data show that they are good managers of properties. There is a study that shows that in those neighborhoods where there are more investors, crime rates go down, for example. The quality of the neighborhood improves. So if this is a new market, the single family rentals, that is kind of a transition. So people who want to go into home ownership, they can rent for a few years before they buy their home. So I don't think, you know, then yes, maybe the neighborhood characteristics might change if there is a lot of turnover, right? If you have, you know, new tenants every 2-3 years and you don't have this, create this community. But it is a market that is, you know, the reason it exists is that there was a need and there was this gap of people wanting to, you know, needing a house, and then they found it was better for them to rent at this point in time before they could buy. So the institutional investors are fulfilling some market need and some demand for these.
That was Athena Tsutharu, a finance professor at the University of Miami, Florida. Coming up, we're drilling down on what it means when your neighborhood gets targeted by Wall Street investors. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a special series from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Anna Staber. First-time homebuyers in the United States are, on average, 36. That's 6 years older than they were less than a generation ago. Millennials are waiting longer to buy. And when they do, it can feel like they're in a tug-of-war with Wall Street and their local home flippers. After all, who can compete with all-cash, as-is offers? Jean Slater has studied affordable housing for decades. Slater advised federal, state, and local housing agencies for more than 40 years and has co-founded CSG Advisors. He also wrote a book about housing segregation that we're going to dissect in Episode 5. He joins Republican Senator Bill Blessing and I now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome, Jean.
Good morning.
So it's natural for investors to want to capitalize on an opportunity. And after the housing collapse, banks were suddenly the owners of hundreds, if not thousands, of homes. So, Jean, what's wrong with these investors coming in and buying up all these empty homes to rent them out?
Well, first of all, I don't think the homes are empty. I mean, people living there, especially in today's market. But the issue is, I think your previous guest touched on it, but the issue is that Wall Street has now found a way to compete with and in effect undermine the entire American homeownership system that was created 90 years ago with FHA and low down payment mortgages and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because individual buyers can't compete with entities that at a click of a computer can buy 1,000 homes at a time. And so it sort of undermines the entire system. Some of the consequences of that are in wide range of kinds of neighborhoods. You wind up destabilizing neighborhoods that were traditionally homeownership. You wind up denying the opportunity to become homeowners. You have out-of-state investors, in effect, crowding out local families. One inevitable effect of that is it both pushes up rents, because these are higher end rentals, and it pushes up prices because families have to bid more, have to bid a higher percentage of their income in order to buy homes. So anyway, those are, I think, the impacts. And to me, the question is, what can be done about that if you don't believe that's a good outcome for American neighborhoods and American families and homeownership in the country?
When we start to talk about what can be done about it, I do want to ask, because Senator Blessing and I have been talking about, how do we define an institutional investor? How many homes do they own? So what is your definition of institutional investor?
I think the approach that we designed, and we worked through various levels, was to look at a level far beyond that, which historically we've had small institutional investors around the country, mom and pop landlords who wind up buying two homes here. They own the home their grandparents had owned. They buy smaller numbers of properties in a local market. So in the work that we did, we looked at making that cutoff something like 50. If you own more than 50 rental single family homes, this is a group that you could then define in a way that you could do something about. Another way of thinking about this is, that we started with is that individuals are limited in the amount of interest deduction they can take to $750,000. In effect, you can look at that same notion and say, should there be a limit on institutional investors at like $75 million? Some number that's clearly different from mom and pop landlords. So that's the kind of way of trying to divide the universe, I think.
We're going to talk tax policy in just a moment, but I want to also talk about rents because ultimately that's what these institutional investors are doing, right? They're buying these homes and they're renting them out. And there's a real controversy that I'm hoping you can explain, Senator Blessing, over how they decide what they're going to charge their customers.
Yeah, this is something that I've been, investigating here for the past several months after I saw a I think it was a ProPublica article regarding RealPage, and it sort of dovetails nicely to into one of the issues that I've run into is that this concentration of ownership also leads to less competition. So in a healthy ecosystem of small housing providers, you have more competition, offers of lower rents to get people to, buy into whatever unit they might be renting out. But when you have this large concentration of ownership, there's less competition and, more likelihood of higher prices. I mean, if you study monopolies, that's the sort of thing that they do. But RealPage and how that operated seems to be even more insidious in the sense, and there is that federal lawsuit. Whereby these larger housing providers decided they were going to turn over, their rental information, the units that they rent, to RealPage, who then aggregates all of this data and suggests, the rent prices, and they are obviously significantly higher. And it's been accused of as a large price fixing scheme, and it's been attributed as one of the factors in pushing rents up. So, obviously, there's not a lot that I can do about that at the state level, but it's something that we should watch and I think is a major problem.
Gene, I want to bring you back here because one of the things we've been talking about is the types of homes that are being bought. And on average, according to some of your investigations, they're about 26% below the statewide average or the area average. And I wanted to ask you, why are minority home buyers hit worse by this institutional investor trend?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, the homes that these institutional investors buy are typically entry-level homes. They're not the resale, they're not the higher homes that people are buying after they've become home buyers and moving up. They tend to be the entry-level homes because they're seen as more of an opportunity for, for rental growth in those. So that's one reason. Entry-level homes are the homes basically for first-time home buyers in this country, whether they're minorities or non-minorities, doesn't matter. So I think that's the broad pattern. And then secondly, what you've seen is a concentration in areas where, in particular neighborhoods, where there's perceived opportunities for future rent or price growth. And those tend to be, and or have been, targeted by institutional investors. Often are the areas where minorities were otherwise beginning to buy, and there are opportunities to overcome the past impacts of segregation and lack of household wealth. So I think you have those two reasons that are driving this. But the most important thing is it's Wall Street, it's these firms, whatever they in their methodology determines is this is the area we ought to buy in. They then focus in that area, and that becomes a concern for the people who live in that area, for the people who wanted to live in that area, for their children who want to buy homes. That's what happens, and there's no way of, and once this has been developed by Wall Street, it's now a tool that's going to be widely available for any opportunity that can be used, unless we do something about it.
Let's talk about tax policy. So I want to understand the federal tax breaks that institutional investors get when they buy a home, because it sounds like they get what I get. They just get it for 1,000, 10,000, 20,000 homes.
Yeah, that's one level. They get the same interest deductions, except it's not limited in any way. But they also get a depreciation, as any investor owner gets a depreciation deduction. So, which is often worth even more than the interest deduction. So the question, as we started, the question we started with was, what can actually be done? There were various proposals. We ought to ban institutional investors. We ought to impose a special excise fee on them, none of which I think are constitutional and couldn't be done. So the question is, rather than just wringing our hands or proposing ideas that really can't happen, is there a way that's politically possible and that's economically feasible and it's legally possible to simply change the incentives that are driving these purchases? Because part of what's driving why are Wall is Wall Street now focusing on theirs? One is they found a way to make this happen. But secondly, it's after the as a result of the pandemic, all this money that had been raised in institutional investor funds by Blackstone and many other groups, you weren't going to go out and buy office buildings. You weren't going to go out and buy hotels. You weren't going to go out and buy shopping centers. So all this money got focused in only two areas, one in industrial warehouse space, but secondly in rental housing. So you had this new concentration of wealth. So the question is, how do we can we simply remove the tax subsidies? And in effect, American taxpayers, ordinary families, are providing the funding that is limiting their opportunities and limiting the American homeownership system. I've thought of the idea we concocted or and have been explaining to people and have gotten a lot of support for. Is it's the free market for home ownership effort. And I can explain that the approach if you want, but let's see where you want to go.
Yeah, actually, we're getting down to the last couple of minutes. So I want to give Senator Blessing a chance to. There's a question for both of you that I like to ask is that, in the larger landscape of what we're calling the housing crisis, how much of a role do you think these institutional investors play?
So, I mean, it's a large role, but it's obviously a role that's more locals. You're not going to see them playing in rural areas as much as they are in some of these targeted starter home neighborhoods, as we've seen.
What, how big of a, I guess, Gene, it's the same question, essentially. How much of a role do institutional investors play to the overall price of houses?
I think there are lots of studies, analyzing this, and I think the impact is in concentrated areas. It has a major. The impact is if families can't buy homes, there are fewer homes they can buy. We're in an all-time shortage of housing supply of available homes to buy as people stay in their homes longer, and with high mortgage rates. So, given that all-time low supply, it's further reducing that supply, forcing families to bid up and pay higher percent for a limited number because out-of-town investors are buying the homes that traditionally local families were able to become first-time home buyers.
That was Jean Slater, a national housing expert and co-founder of CJS Advisors. He'll be joining us in 2 weeks to talk about the wealth gap between white Americans and Black Americans. But next week on Untangled, we're unraveling the cost of everything: childcare, college, inflation, wages, and how they all fit into this puzzle of a housing crisis. That's Monday at 11 on 89.7 NPR News, or you can subscribe to Untangled on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and listen to new episodes whenever you'd like. That'll do it for this hour of Untangled. Our show's intern producer is Chris Corcoran. Board operation is by Cameron Howard. And WOS News and Public Affairs Director is Mike Thompson. Radio Operations Director is Kevin Petrilla. Senior Broadcast Technician is Dalton Jones. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides.